Today we're going to continue on with our talk of change, changing behaviors, to move out into our communities. So how can some of the change theory that we've already talked about and some new change theory help to address change within our communities? So when we first started talking about this in January, I was like, oh, this is great. I'll teach them the whole PROCEED change theory model. And PROCEED PRECEED is an acronym. And then I was like, no, that's probably too much. So as much as I love it, we won't go into that. This is a much more simplified model. And I'm going to go over this at the end, but there is a fantastic resource from the University of Kansas puts out called the Community Toolbox. That's Community Something Toolbox. That just, if you're interested in community change or are in charge of making a change in your community, I really recommend going through there. So we'll talk about that a little bit more later. All right, so assess. We've heard this before, right? If you want to make a change in your community, the first thing you want to do is to assess. And this is another time where it might be important to think about whether it's relevant or not. So you might think, there is a huge problem with teenagers toilet papering around here. But it might be interesting to like look at some larger data to see if it is maybe just an individual problem you're having, or if that is a problem that's community-wide that would require a lot of time and energy. We want to start with assessment all the time, if whether there is a problem or not. All right? That's okay. Well, how many of you are new?
You have to hear on the TV.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm Beth, and this is Ben, and I am a nurse working now managing a unit, and Ben is?
I'm a professor at the Lugan School of Theology in Chicago. Teach ritual, liturgy, and eco-theology.
And my experience with this is both as a bedside nurse, now helping units making changing, and then also in public health. All right, so today is more of the public health stuff. So once you've assessed the problem, and this is something I really want to emphasize, gathering a community of people. So I've had great opportunity to work on a number of committees, of coalitions to make community change. And the most beautiful thing and the most effective thing is when you have gathered stakeholders from the community from all different areas. So for example, I'm on a homeless coalition right now. We have people from the YMCA. We have people from the police force, people from the hospitals, people from the like food co-op. We have people from the YMCA. We have mental health people there. We have child care people there. We just have from every aspect that you might consider. And we have people who have either been homeless or who are currently homeless. So when you're when you've got an issue that you think as a community you need to work on and you're getting ready to work on it, assembling a group of people that has many different voices, this is possibly the most important thing you can do. And please don't forget people from the population that you are trying to affect. When I was in the Women's Treatment Center, Substance Abuse Treatment Center for Women, and assessing what needs they had, what we heard from the actual people being treated for whom we were making these changes was way different than what we thought we knew was the needs. So that's the first thing I learned. So this looks an awful lot like my favorite nursing process. And this is honestly, this is every community change model that you can find, no matter what it's called, no matter how many letters in the acronym, this is actually what is at the heart of all of those. You start with the assessment, and this is once you have a problem. So we're going to talk about an example of a child abuse. When you assess, you get that group of people together, you talk about what everybody thinks is the problem. You might brainstorm with like sticky notes on the wall. You don't stop there. Most towns, most counties, most states have sort of community assessments that are done. And I'll show you a place where you can find those for your own communities. It may be your state, depending on how small your area is. But what we, and then you can also look at sort of what we call the literature. So what you Google online, and then if you find some actual literature from sources that you trust, when you find the point where the literature meets the data, meets what your stakeholders are saying, that's the point that you want to go at. So you assess the situation, and you find out the problem, and then you make a plan. And this is where we come back to those SMART phrases. You want to make a plan. And this right here, the planning stage, is where you want to make your goals. So you want to know whether you're meeting your goals or not, so you need to have that before you even make a plan. All right. Then you do the acting. You implement your change, always evaluating against the goals you made in the plan, and then always talking about how we can sustain this. So we'll go over this more later, but that's just an introduction. Another thing that we look at, are you familiar with this term, social determinants of health? This is another real key. So say we have a problem, childhood obesity, which we do have in our country, and we'll talk about that later as an example. We know that, and we've learned this in like the first session, we know that just educating the parents may not make a difference. Right? Because we've done that. We've educated everybody. We know what causes obesity. Too much sugar, not enough vegetables, not enough exercise. We all know this, and yet we have a huge problem. It is what 1 in 5 of our children in America, according to the CDC, are obese. So we know what that is. So we need to look further into our communities and into our systems to see what's supporting that. So we're going to talk about that. But the social determinants of health are conditions that either support or limit the health of the community or population. And one thing that we really want to focus on is access to power and resources. If people don't have power and they don't have resources, there isn't going to be change. So we really want to focus on that area. And then we also want to focus on the conditions of daily life. So what does the social arena look like where people are? The political area, the economic, and the environmental. And here's a nice little table thing showing about this. So here are some of them.
The SDOH is
Social Determinants of Health. And this comes actually from Healthy People 2020. Does anyone know what that is? Mm-hmm. I'd like to introduce this. It would be interesting to Google. This is the United States health assessment for the population. So the United States community of the United States has its own community assessed health assessment, Healthy People 2020. You can see all the goals that came out of there and all that's been being worked on, and probably your public health departments are working off of this, these goals also, I hope. So social determinants of health, the neighborhood and the built environment. This could include infrastructure. It could include the ways, like the how well your housing is, things like that. Health and healthcare. Access to healthcare, how close it is to people, what types of healthcare. Do people have to travel 40 minutes to see a pediatrician? Social and community context, what sort of opportunities do we have for people? What sort of things are available? Do you have a white YMCA? Also, this would be sort of your community's beliefs and values would be there too. Your education system. Economic stability. So let's look at how this looks. So I was part of a childhood obesity coalition in Oak Park. So we knew we had a childhood obesity problem, and it matched this. Although Oak Park is generally socioeconomically doing pretty well, we have pockets that are not, and we're actually right on the cusp of the Austin neighborhood, which is one of the most difficult neighborhoods in Chicago. So 1 out of 5, this is what we found in Oak Park. So this is not really, obesity for children is not really affected by socioeconomic or anything else. So we started by looking at the determinants of health, and this is what we found. We found that if we're trying to get children to exercise more, the best way to do that is to be able to get them to do that on their way to and from school, after school, that sort of thing. We had lots of roads without sidewalks and without crosswalks, especially on the way from the neighborhoods to the school. We found that we did not, like, our main sort of clinic that takes Medicare doesn't take appointments, so people do not go to get primary care there, because you might go and sit all day long, and then they say, no, we don't have any time for you. We found that a lot of kids didn't have anywhere to go after school, so they were going home eating junk food, no exercise, watching TV. We found, again, that there were a lot of areas where children, it was not safe for them to cross the street. And we found that a lot of children were not having access to healthy food throughout the day. So instead of just educating the parents, educating the children who have no control over what they're eating, we've worked on some of these. So this is what it looks like now. We made sure that there were some bike lanes between the neighborhoods and the schools. We did nothing about this because we didn't have any control over this or time or energy. So this is still the same, although it was a little better with Obamacare, this is a problem still. The YMCA opened more after-school programs that included physical education and made them at prices that people could afford. So they offered this service because they were around the table talking about it. We made sure that there were places where that were safe for children to cross, but by increasing crossing guards. And we made sure that the lunches looked more like this than what they were getting. So we figured if we could control their breakfast and their lunches a little bit more, including the education to help them eat it, we might do some good. So we're still waiting to see if that's done some good, but that's an example of the social determinants of health.
So I'm going to give one quick look at one lens that I've used a lot with my students. And I often begin a class that I teach on environmental injustice asking people, tell me the messages that you received when you were growing up in your church about the environment. And let's just popcorn out some words that you might have heard in churches about environment. What do you hear? What images that come to mind?
Garden
of Eden, God's creation. What are you supposed to do about the environment?
Stewards.
Tend and care.
Tend and care. Recycle. Right? Plant a tree. Right? So those are all good things. There's a whole body of research that's like kind of a community assessment that's around the idea of environmental justice. And I gave you a whole handout that's got basically, I summarize, I don't know, like 10 or 15 different sources that can break it down for you. But basically, you can think of it like this. It is environmental, the question of environmental justice has to do with the inequitable distribution of environmental benefits and burdens, including lack of participation in environmental decision making, right? One of the ways I think about this theologically, which populations in this world have the sins, bear in their body the environmental sins of the world? So picture what happens when Katrina comes or another storm comes in Houston. The communities we call fence line communities are beside chemical plants. When everybody who's got access to their own vehicles is fleeing the city, there's groups of people who are left behind and are literally getting gassed by companies who are letting these toxic emissions come out. Or communities who live beside very busy roads. Truck companies can drive by there in a diesel truck. All this stuff is coming out. It's as if they're like forcing cigarettes into kids' mouths. They have no choice as to whether they want to do that. It's often people of low income and people of color. And they have very little decision-making power on how much of these toxins that they're ingesting. So it's one lens to do a kind of read of a community.
And as you're looking at making changes in your community, you might think, I'm making a health change, so I need to look at the body. Or you might think, for example, asthma, like maybe we need to pass out more medications, when actually what we need to do is look at some of the environment of where it is. So here's just a few takeaways that we're going to take with us. Making connections creates strong partnerships, and diversity matters. So that's the other thing. Your as far as socioeconomic, as far as racial, as far as cultural diversity, it would be helpful in these groups of people if they matched what you have in the actual community. Always assess first. Create measurable goals. Find out what has worked for others, then creatively adjust to to your own community. And that resource that I'll give you later will give you a lot of information about what has worked in other communities. You can also find that online all the time. What have other people done about this issue? It doesn't mean you'll be able to cookie cutter put it on yours, but you can always start there. We might as well start with what has worked. Don't forget the social determinants of health, and always consider injustice. Mostly when you're working on these, when you're working on issues, the injustice will pop up. Yes?
I don't know if there's a name for this law or pattern, but like when you create walkability, when you change the environment, then like people will do what's the easiest.
Yep.
So for kids, if junk food's there and it tastes good, they'll eat it. There's no one stopping them. And if once there's bike paths, kids love to bike.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting thinking about, I think it's important for us to think about what are those systems where we can affect change that then it'll just keep having a ripple effect.
Yeah, definitely. As we change the environment, I used to say this all the time, my kids are throwing their clothes in this place, so let's put the laundry basket in that place rather than forcing them to put it somewhere else.
I've got two beautiful images, too, of that point. Like, it's kind of, you can do it with a law, right, to kind of try, and it usually doesn't work, or you can kind of offer people this wonderful way of life, but it usually involves a system, an infrastructure. Yeah.
So over the next time, we're going to be giving you some examples of change and how changes happen, like actual changes in community and how they've happened. We're hoping this will be educational, sort of spark in your mind things that you might be interested in changing ways, and we'll talk through how these changes have been made. And we just hope it's inspirational. So remember, I'm just going to go through a few of these. We went through these today, so we won't have to go through them too much, but I want you to really keep these in your mind and be looking for these things. These bottom two are on the one that's stapled, the second page of the handout, you can look. This is one that we've used, a model we've used all 3 days. When you're making any changes, you need to look at things from the individual level, what the individual knows and believes, the individual's values. So in a population of people, that might be the same, it might be different, but relationships between individuals and their families, individuals and the community and then the society, and then how even the relationships between the community and society. So all those intermix, all right? For example, the childhood obesity, here's an example of how the societal changes. We did put a soda tax. It was very controversial, but Oak Park did have a soda tax that they ended up placing. I think it's getting revoked, but it was a good try. So just keep in mind all of these models, the social determinants of health, the assess, plan, act, evaluate, sustain, and then how all of our different ripples of relationships affect change as we go through these.
So here are some examples. One of the you may have heard already just this summer, Central Park, for decades, groups of people have been working to make it more friendly for people to actually be people there and not for cars. And so I think it was June 1st, this is the very last car making its way through Central Park, and now it's available for bikers and people on horseback and walkers and skaters. Central Park hosts 35 million people per year, and this is the beauty of the future that we're looking for in a fossil fuel-free future. So there's just a quick glimpse. They did it in Central Park. We can do it. They're doing it in other parks. Here's some of you. This is one of my favorite kind of set of images in the world that I know of. This is in South Korea. This was a multi-level highway. You can see, I don't even know how many lanes were there, in a kind of through residential buildings. The noise and the fumes was becoming kind of unlivable for people. And they began with this dream. Under this highway lived an ancient sacred stream. Would it be possible to bring it back? And they did. They tore up, they removed that highway and made a 5-mile long city park. And tell me you don't want to go there. Instead of this massive highway, it draws people all times during the day and different seasons to this beautiful place. In Seoul, South Korea, I should say. So now I'm going to spend a little bit more time with this thing that I'm a little obsessed with now in my research agenda, it's natural burial, as another way of kind of reshaping our community and ecological health. So what is natural burial? 3 easy ways to distinguish it. No chemical embalming, biodegradable,
burial vessels like shrouds or pine boxes or kind of basket caskets. And then when you return to the earth, you're not in a kind of SUV coffin or in a vault, but just into the ground. And sometimes your body contributes kind of legal protection to like a nature preserve. So I'm going to show a few ways that just kind of just exactly to this point of how when we begin to modify our landscape or our patterns, it begins to pay benefits back to us. So first we could say one thing that this does certainly, these are all images of natural burial, conservation burial, that this practice ritualizes the connection between our bodies and the earth from which we were made, right? Which our scriptural tradition says you can't really distinguish that. It's the same thing. This is a key insight in the environmental justice community. What we do to the earth, we do to our bodies. And especially in the womanist wing, just kind of African, kind of a derivation of feminism in African American circles, they say especially let's look at the way that women of color and the way their bodies disproportionately receive burdens that are placed on them. But all of us, our bodies are the earth. So there's no, we don't get to throw anything away. All of us are part of this cycle. Some ways that natural burial, conservation burial, changes people's spiritual lives, especially when it is conservation burial. People in their last act, sometimes you can think about a last will and testament, and that's this kind of legal document. But your body actually becomes a gift to protect it from Walmart or bulldozers. So here's, this is actually a headstone in one of these conservation burial grounds that Evelyn says, thank you. Thanks for a life of clean air and clean water, and now I give this back to you as a last act. It helps people reimagine, remember we talked about yesterday, salvation as the earth being healed back toward paradise. The early church had a lot of this imagery of what it would look like. Heaven to them looked like the Garden of Eden, and that the death of Jesus opens the path back into paradise. There is an embrace in even capitalist and consumer societies of a simplicity. Here's a quote from a woman talking about her own casket. I would never want one of those big brass handle things. It doesn't disintegrate, and I think that's important. I hate all that. I don't mind giving money if I have to at the time of death. But what do people with no money do? It's just horrendous that for some people they have to think about all that money before they die. So the idea that a shroud and a hole in the ground can be a place of great honor and dignity. One thing that I love as a ritual scholar is anytime we're burying a human being or even a pet, there's a way in which it creates this charged ritual space. And we're kind of asking, what does this mean? And so if a hawk flies over or a butterfly comes by during a burial, people who haven't spent much time in the wild suddenly see it as like charged with meaning. And they often interpret it as a kind of message that their loved one is being held in the earth and by God. Here's a quote of a guy when he talked about when they laid someone down into the ground. At that moment, when we put the body in the grave, there was a gasp. And the people, we all looked up, and there was a hawk, a 3-foot raptor with a 3-foot wingspan, a big old hawk circling right above the grave, and it just circled right into the heavens. So all of those people, maybe they came from the city, have this sense of a kind of nature mysticism that gets charged at a burial. And they're going to carry that with them for their lives, right? It's something that we need to return to in our Western societies. Some people go and have maybe choose a plot in these natural burial grounds in beautiful springtime, but then the death comes maybe in November or January, and they're often kind of shocked by what this looks like. But when that happens, in the research I've done and others have done, people find that over time, as they continue to return to the grave over years and seasons, these people, because of a burial in this place, have a deeper appreciation for the cycles of life on Earth and the cycles of their own heart. That there will be times of barrenness, of harvest, of dormancy, of springtime growth, and it gives them a patience with the earth itself and with life itself. Something that, again, in our kind of impatient society, we need to have more of. So instead of just a sense that there's only death, but that it's all part of a cycle. Yeah. So a few examples then of natural burial grounds. This came up in Vespers last night as one of the examples. You can see this kind of deforested land over here. This is in England. It's the largest natural burial ground now in England. The Church of England bought this area that had been completely deforested. And now they first planted these 25,000 little whips of trees into these glades, and then invited people and said, who wants to be part of a project, a 100-year project of turning this into a thriving forest? And people, and really, it's a non-romantic landscape. You can see it's not really pretty yet, but they're saying, I want to give my life as part of a project for my great-grandchildren and all the creatures that will be here after me. And they actually doubled the size of the natural burial ground because so many people have been interested in this. For those of us who are in the city, this is our church, and we're about a block away from Wrigley Field in Chicago. But we've got this little paradise garden beside our church, and it's a pretty young congregation, so we don't have people die very often, but sometimes when we do, at the end of the Eucharist, the cross goes out, maybe the incense comes with us, but also comes the ashes, the remains of one of our members. We all process into this garden where during the summer, have our coffee hour, and we commend them to the earth in the garden. So our little vision of paradise, it's a very beautiful garden, tended well, is a place where we also remember that the saints are with us even there. And then I'll show you this image. This is pretty intense. So one of the critiques of the natural burial movement, we say, is it's not a problem that we're doing cremation, but we're doing it kind of in a siloed way. My friend Suzanne Kelly calls it industrial incineration rather than cremation. Here's a little town. This was this town's idea. And they said, let's do this in a ritually beautiful and honest way. So they created a ritual cremation area where people can come using natural local woods and have these cremations. It was so popular, they had to limit it only to people who live in this little town. But if you're interested, you could look this up and check it out.
Can I make a comment then? I wonder how that people's experience of letting go is impacted, especially by that process, even more so than even burial, because you're just like, wow, this person's really gone.
Yeah, that's one. It's definitely that the process of letting go seems both more full and harder and intense. One of the pastors that I interviewed who had done her first natural burial talked about how she had kind of pictured it as like beautiful, nice earth, and like we're returning someone to the earth, because you often fill the grave while you're there, just like most of our ancestors did. But it was a really cold day, and she talked about how, so she had the shovel and picked it up, and she was like, my God, she felt so horrible. It was like these huge clods of bang hitting the coffin. And she said, you know, there's not a worse sound in the world than the first shovel full of dirt that hits a coffin, you know. And this one was especially percussive. The ones I've been part of, people weep more openly. But one of my students, when we were talking about this, was saying about this, maybe you've seen this in American funeral practice, that often the cemetery directors will say, oh, you can go now, leave now, while the coffin is still on this kind of contraption. Everybody leaves, and then they're okay. Now we can do the secret thing, and we're actually going to lower them in the ground. And one of my students said, we don't bury our dead in the United States. We leave them there. What kind of culture would not bury their dead? So in the natural burial movement, we often do that. And now, today, even it's kind of rare even to go to the cemetery at all. Tom Long says, the dead are increasingly banned from their own funerals. So in an era where we really need to recover the sense of the connection between our bodies and the earth, there's nothing better than a funeral that kind of embodies that. We don't go to the earth anymore, we don't go to the grave, and we often don't have a body. We do memorial services and celebrations of life instead of an actual burial. So here's some resources. If you're thinking about how you might like to assess your community or assess your own death practices, I'm going to give you some resources for all these different levels. The first place to think about making change in burial practices is this great book called Final Rites by Josh Slocum and Lisa Carlson. And it goes, there's chapters on every state, what the rites are there, what you can do as an individual, and what you might want to do with your church or with a land trust to establish a conservation burial ground, or even if you have agricultural land. It includes even options for open-air cremations. That would probably be a little much for me, but for some people, that might be appropriate. So that book will help you know who to get in touch with in each state to make changes and what you're allowed to do. The Green Burial Guidebook just came out this year. It's pretty popular level, but it's super up-to-date, and it's a great overview of everything you need to know, as well as some really practical information, like how deep should you dig a grave? And it's not 6 feet. That 6 feet was actually established as a norm when you were doing like bunk bed graves. So 3 to 4 feet is what's usually the best. That's where the biologically active soil is best. Greening Death by Suzanne Kelly is probably the most academic, intellectual approach to this. But she also, herself, she's a scholar and an activist, and now sits on the board of a green cemetery that she helped develop in North Rhinebeck, New York. Green Burial Council is kind of the clearinghouse for all the information you want on green burial. And if you go to their website, you can get a drop-down list of all the certified green cemeteries and green funeral providers in your state. I wish they were a little more radical. I wish they were a little more deep green. Sometimes it's kind of like, hey, if you're interested in a little bit of a green consumer approach to death, you can do it. But they're good people, they're honest, and it's a great place to start. And then this is my research area, so there's my Twitter handle, and I often tweet about this stuff, and I'll tweet links to news stories and updates on that.
Just a little bit more about some of the conservation that's happening.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Just a little bit more about that.
A little bit more about conservation? Okay, so, I'm not quite sure what I would say about that, but the idea is, well, if you picture a typical United States cemetery, you're going to have kind of a mown field treated with pesticides. And Mark Harris, who wrote another book on this, said, I want you to think about, should we be calling these cemeteries? Are we actually burying people because of how much stuff is under the ground? Are we actually burying people in landfills? We bury enough steel every year in the United States as caskets to rebuild the Brooklyn Bridge. And tons and tons of concrete, all this embalming fluid. So if you could pull back the ground, the amount of in a cemetery that's actually human beings is quite small. And in these conservation burial grounds, what will often happen is maybe, this is the way, there's one outside of Atlanta where there's the Arabian Mountain Preserve is this large natural area. And there was a threatened part of it out here where somebody wanted to butt up against it and build a strip mall and kind of suburban sprawl out here. And a bunch of monks said, we'd like to do what we can to preserve that land. And they came up with the largest Roman Catholic natural burial ground in the United States. So this area became an expansion without having to pass anything through the state legislature or get a law passed. But they just did it, and it became a land trust and a natural burial ground. And you can tool around in there and see just thriving wildlife, something that would be very different in a kind of typical American cemetery. Mm-hmm. All right.
Question. What kind of things do you want to say about resistance from the ordinary people as well as the undertakers?
Oh, right. So resistance to the natural burial movement. There's, sadly, an enormous amount of misinformation. To me, the point of resistance often is someone who will kind of, to use the kind of current phrase, mansplain to you that's actually not legal, or that's not healthy. And many times it's people who have misunderstood. And what I think usually happens is the funeral industry produces these documents that makes it sound like it's a law, like it's against the law. You have to embalm somebody if it's 48 hours or something. And it's almost never the case. So final rites, Carlson and Slocum are activists, and they've been resisting the kind of funeral industry for a long time. So getting information about that is super important. They're often good people, just quite misinformed. Yeah.
The funeral industry that I know is really invested, the whole identity is taken out of it. It's like if somebody develops a nuclear bomb, the same kind of mentality. You make your living, but your whole personal self-image is consumed by this.
Right.
And I sympathize with that, but I don't want to go along with it either.
Right, yeah, exactly. So the it's actually chemical companies who started the embalming business, like to sell those chemicals, and they set up the training schools. And then they were taught by people who said, humans will be traumatized if they kind of understand that these bodies are gonna decompose, or if the people actually look dead instead of alive when they're in the coffin, right? They were taught that. So if we go a little bit, I'm looking at your shirt here, if we go back a little bit, Native American teachers have told us that the strongest acts of resistance to European invasion and genocide had to do with the fact that these lands were full of the bodies of their ancestors. So natural and conservation burial is its own way of resistance, and it's been meeting resistance since the first time Europeans got here. So we ought to expect a little bit of a struggle. Yeah.
Is there anything biblical about, is there anything in the Old or New Testament about sort of body after death?
Oh yeah, this is a huge topic. So I'd love to talk to you about, especially if you look at the wisdom tradition, not just in the identified wisdom books, but the very first thing we get about this is in Genesis, you're dust. And it's a different kind of anthropology. Our bodies return to dust, and our breath returns to God who gave it. So even now, I'm a dust creature, and I'm filled with the breath of God. And then in the wisdom tradition, often repeatedly will point out, we all share the same breath. The wolverines, the humans, the little children, breath and dust.
Does the Apostle Paul say something else about this?
Oh, it gets really complicated with kind of, you know, Platonic and Greek influences. But the way, here, shorthand, when you read the word soul, and in the, you know, we'll talk about soul and spirit, read that, the Hebrew tradition would instead translate that either as breath or as entire kind of life force. And so, especially in the Western tradition, we've gotten it messed up. It's a really interesting reread of the tradition. When you hear about the separation of body and soul, the Hebrew tradition would originally have said body and breath. And the breath goes back to God when we have it here, right? There's no word for some kind of disembodied soul in Hebrew. It doesn't exist. Like, your soul is your suke. It's everything. It's your whole essence. It didn't ever get separated from the body. It's just your breath. But, yeah, it's a very interesting topic.
So a few things just to point out back to the scientific, whatever. A few things to point out about this. One thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about the funeral people and resistance to a movement. So if you were interested in starting something like a green burial, either to conserve a bit of land in your area or to provide something for your church or your community, as hard as it would be, invite those guys to the table. That's a diversity and a voice you would have to have there, as much as you would be getting resistance. And I mean, I think when we talk about diversity of voices at the table and really starting some of these movements, it's important to have all of the voices at the table in order for things to work. And then the other thing
I want... one thing to that?
Oh, yeah.
And it's equality of voice, so mm-hmm. not letting yourself get mansplained by it.
True. And then the other thing I just do want to point out, in some of these movements, obviously there aren't a bunch of people sitting around a table at most of the time. But the movement is thinkers, it's people, it's people wishing for change. And you see in those books the voices at the table. So that's a different way of thinking about coming together to make community change, and it's a good place to start. All right. This is an example of change, and this is actually from my hospital. It's a small community hospital in Oak Park, Illinois. And this is an example of how our hospital worked with other members of the community, other agencies in the community, to make what seems like a really simple change that has made a really big change in a lot of people's lives. And the other thing I want to point out about this is this started from
from a community grant. So when you're thinking about those different ripples and how the community can help you, this started from a pretty small community grant, but one that Oak Park gives out that you have to win. And then the other thing that helps with this is our hospital, because it's a nonprofit, at least when I left to come to the village, it was like this. Who knows if it's still the same? But we did get, and I think we still do, get some tax advantage when we give community hours to the community. So I think most nonprofits need to show that they have specific community hours. So that that governmental influence helps our CEO to see the importance of us giving time and money to something like this.
No, pizza is in that pot. I didn't tell them.
We call it tomato and toast.
I still love meatloaf to this day. Yeah. It's like Sunday meatloaf pot.
Every Wednesday was pasta day. I'm from the South, so anything that you boil, anything that you can grow in the garden.
My grandma's oatmeal cookies, you could smell them coming down the street.
Dressing, ham, on holidays.
When I think of taking care of people or helping someone, my initial thought is, oh, I'll feed them.
When I was growing up, there was always enough food to meet our nutritional needs at three meals a day, but there wasn't anything left over. So I was often a little hungry as a child.
For me, growing up, I definitely had issues financially with my family where my parents may not have gotten to eat. They definitely made sure that I had something, whether it be a grilled cheese or a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. To me, it was the world.
I was homeless in 2006. Six and a half months pregnant with my daughter, not knowing whether you're going to eat or not, or if you're going to have a bag that night, it's hard.
My daughter, right today, won't eat Polish sausages because for 4 months straight, that's all I bought. I buy two packs of Polish sausages because it would go further than any other meat. You know, I did that, but I kept my kids alive and I kept them fed.
Nationwide, one in every seven people struggles with hunger or is food insecure. That really increases if there are children in the family. So for families with children, it's one in five people struggle with hunger. Locally, our largest food insecurity hub that we serve is Austin community, and about one in three people struggle with hunger in the Austin community.
Austin neighborhood is very historical. There is a lot of poverty, but here at Wild West, it's just a whole different vibe. We really want the kids to come in and really want them to feel welcome here. You all have a zillion meals that y'all have put together, and it's always something that our kids like.
I've been living in Oak Park for 35 years, and I've been here at Mills Park Tower for 10, Section 8 housing here.
The Surplus Project is a great project which was launched 2 months ago, and it's been quite successful thus far.
When I finally heard about the Surplus Project, I went in the locker room and I said, yes.
The boss comes over, we are going to send the food. Oh, I say, thank God we do this.
I think we just didn't realize how much was going to waste. And we've got people that we know are going hungry and in need of food. To see so much going into the garbage was really heartbreaking for us.
The cafeteria serves food to the public, and at the end of the shift, they have some leftover that hasn't gone out to the public in a pan behind the shield. And so what they do, either their staff members or volunteers, is they'll come in and take that food and put it together into an individual container that's recyclable and is microwavable. And they'll put together an actual meal that has usually a starch, a protein, and a vegetable. So they put those together and then they refrigerate them. And then volunteers come from usually the recipient organization some later time that day, pick those up, put them in insulated bags, and transport those within 40 minutes to the recipient site. So in addition to those 1,000 meals per month that we are providing people, the corollary of that is that 1,000 pounds of waste is not going into the waste stream. So in just this year, over 6 tons of product has been diverted from the waste stream to people who need it.
The fish. Yes.
Saves us on money, traveling. It's very beneficial for the people that stay in the Y. Very beneficial. I love it.
I feel better because, like, when I don't eat at school, and it just, it gives me energy, some more energy. I feel like I could do more. Yeah. I feel happy.
I'm in a computer program, so now I'm more alert. So the food you guys are providing is enabling me to learn more.
For me, it was a great civics lesson for the young men that we work with. It's connecting them with the larger community. In the face of divisiveness, this is a great way to say, well, I'm not divided from people that are different or my neighbors.
I wish that the surplus project was a nationwide project to any institution that deals with food or whatever and throws out dumpsters of food every day. That would just be huge.
Surplus Project is a model. It's a model that we should implement everywhere in our nation. It's simple and it's sustainable.
There is waste in every community and there is need in every community. And this is a very simple connection point that I think has limitless possibilities to reach across our region and the country.
All right, so this is an example of something that started with an idea. And somebody had the idea, like, it seems like a lot of people are going hungry, and it seems like we're throwing away a lot of food. We did look at our community assessment, and one of the things that Oak Park and the Greater Chicago community is working on is food insecurity. So that was part of the assessment. It started with a partnership between our hospital, Rush Oak Park, with the food bank, and the YMCA, and the homeless coalition sort of was there too. And then it has grown now. And you saw the different people who are involved with that. The schools had to be involved in order to get the word out that you picked this up. Some mental health institutions also helped with that. Now, this project has expanded so far in the city of Chicago. I think there's now 9 major hospitals, many of the schools. Many people are contributing to this. The resources needed for this was a director. We have volunteers who pick up the food, volunteers from our hospital who package the food. Really, the only thing that needed to be bought were refrigerators. So that's an example of how there was an assessment of need, an assessment of what needed to be done. People came together, they implemented, and they made changes along the way. I think there were some issues. She really emphasized the fact that they were microwavable containers because I think the first ones there might have been some issues with. There's always going to be issues, but that's why you're constantly assessing, making changes, just like in our own personal health care. So that's an example of a change that was made in a community without really too much effort. If you look at the handouts, I'm going to slip over here to the resources. This is the toolbox that I was talking about, the community toolbox from the University of Kansas. It has so much information on it, so many examples of what you might need to make change. It also has examples. It has like a little, I don't know if it's a blog area or what you would call it, but an area where people can share changes that they've made. So I just printed one on here because I wanted to show you when you write in there about your change, you need to write it in the assess, planning, taking action, that whole pattern that we did. So this is one. Somebody in the community, and according to a student survey, they realized that there was a lot of prescription drug misuse. So a group got together to talk about what to do about that. And this is basically the story of them assessing, planning, implementing, looking at how it worked, and then sustaining it, starting with a day where they collected a lot of medications. I think that the impetus or the crisis, which often these will come from a crisis, was that there was an event where people were stealing pills and So anyway, you can read that through and you can kind of see, I printed it because I thought if you're doing that, you can see how all of this works together, including the evaluation and the sustaining. Do you have any questions? Otherwise, I'm really hoping that some of you might have ideas or stories that you can share for inspiration and how it might have gone for you involved in any of these coalitions or in your churches.
I guess I don't have an example of anything, but this gentleman mentioned the resistance. That seems like a daunting thing. I mean, we had, in our local neighborhood, there was some housing proposed for homeless people, and it was an idea that, like, you hear it and you're just like, how could anybody disagree with this? And yet there was a small but very vocal resistance to it, and they were almost able to get it completely shut down. And I think that can be a real frustrating and difficult thing to work against. And even with the funeral, like, you know, when you're at your most vulnerable time, when somebody has died, that's not the time when you're feeling strong to stand up to the funeral industry. And I think that there's a certain amount that they're taking advantage of that in maybe my conspiratory, like, you know, like if they're taking advantage of that, you know, it's an easy place to take advantage. So I don't know if there's a question here or if it's something, are there tools or resources or ways that you can really maybe think just things that you could name that could help work to push back against those resisting forces?
Well, let me ask you a question, first of all. Do you know what ended up keeping the homeless project in your community alive? Do you know? I don't know.
It was that enough people came forward, and once word got out, like, that people are resisting it, then other people were like, well, hey, wait a minute, you know. So it did, I mean, it became a controversy.
So in my experience, and from what I've read, and from what you can find on the community toolbox about meeting resistance, the two main things that seem to counter resistance, well, I'll say three. First of all, is to anticipate the resistance and have some of those people at the table from the beginning. The second thing is, honestly, that we hold each other up. And even when you're talking about, like, in the face of when you're vulnerable, that you have a large enough community behind you holding it up. So I think what you're saying is your community came together and said, no, actually, we do want this. The third one is tricky these days, but it's data. And often, I think you probably all know from what you read in the newspaper and then when you hear the counter conversations, a lot of the decision and a lot of when people are pushing against some of these things, it's because they have incorrect data or they're believing incorrect data. So this is tricky right now, right? Because data and science, the things that we used to rely on and that used to convince people aren't taken quite as seriously. And I think we're all trying to catch up with that, but I think having everyone at the table in the first place, making sure it's relevant, making sure that the community is in it. If the community is not ready or at a place for a change to happen, it may be that you need to work on something else first of all, but having everyone at the table, having enough behind it, and then being able to show that what you're working on will work.
Can I say one more?
Sure.
I think especially religious communities and community organizers have had success with the idea of kind of shining a spotlight on, you know, the actual voices of people who are kind of bearing the sins of others, you know, who are having the burdens placed on them. And then sometimes churches get a little uncomfortable with this. I come from a school of thought where I'm okay with this, where if necessary, you shine a light on the people who are putting the burden on them and shame them. Just put the and tell the truth. And especially not people of privilege, I'm pointing to myself, but the people who are actually experiencing this. I'm trying to get my kids to school. I gotta go work during the day, and we don't have a crosswalk for 3/4 of a mile, and they gotta cross 3 lanes of traffic. How would you feel if your children can have a group of people who know how to say amen, you know, listening to them, get that on the news? That's gonna shame people. And it should shame. We should be ashamed.
Any other thoughts?
Yes. Our church has a grade school a half a block away, and it covers the lower income in Davenport, Iowa. And they saw the need, and so they put together a lunch buddy system where you could go and have lunch with a kid and get to know them. Because, of course, one way we change the world is by one person at a time, loving and walking beside that person. And then they also opened a food pantry because the principal knew the families that, first of all, lived in cars or had a single mom taking care of 5 kids or et cetera, et cetera. And so they would go, our church people, we had one who's paid, the rest of us are volunteers, that goes to the food pantry, gets the food, but also gets food from other places. And people, so the only thing we buy, I believe, is milk and eggs, and everything else is donated, you know, whether it's meats or fresh fruits and vegetables or snacks or soups, or they come out, they can come to our food pantry twice a month, and they leave with a huge cart full of food that sustains them. And they tell us how many are in their family. Let's say there's 1 adult and 5 kids, so that you can judge, you know, how much food. And it's amazing. The people are so grateful and know that their children are going to do better in school because now they've had, you know, a lunch program at school, but they've also have food that mom can take home and fix. And so it's all very regulated. And once you leave that school, unfortunately, you know, another family moves in and takes that place. But we started out with 12 families, and now I think we're doing 60.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
And I would encourage you to take your story to other places in your community, and other places might want to adopt your model.
Yeah.
That's how that
People
goes.
Do come and ask how we got it started.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, but
sure.
It's absolutely worth it.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
Especially since I ended on that kind of resistance shame thing. just that stories like that, and actually I think living in Holden is a place where we kind of sometimes say, well, here's a problem. How can we solve this? Let's have this place called Potty Patrol. We can give things away for free there. We can produce all our own power. So these stories of hope that get shared against a kind of culture of cynicism that, oh, we can never get that, people are just trying to freeload off us. You tell these stories about lives that have been transformed, that gives hope to people and kind of can help blow away the clouds of cynicism.
And then one more thing. We talked before and then we need to wrap it up. Again, we've talked about this with changing at all different levels. It's possible that a movement you work really hard on is going to fail, like in the immediate, just like it's possible our diet, we're going to backtrack, just like we may not do the spiritual practice that we were hoping to do. But I know our son was just working on an initiative that he was very, very passionate about, and it lost by like 3 votes. Mm-hmm. But my point with that is, even looking at that as not necessarily a failure, but just a step mm-hmm. in the right direction, the next time it comes up, you might be, the community might be more ready to hear what's going on. It might start to be more ready for that change. So that's just my last thought. Okay. All right. Well, thanks all for coming on Friday afternoon. And again, feel free to, and please do an evaluation.
Strength for your changes in your own body and spiritual practices and your communities. Great to have you.
Thank you.